So tonight, science and the reality of God. Going to start with something that we all know. It's the obvious. We live in the age of science. We live in the post-Newtonian worldview, and you could even argue that we live in the post-Einstein worldview. It's a very different worldview than, say, a century ago. The way that we view reality in the year 2020 has been forever altered and enriched beyond measure by the discoveries and the breakthroughs of modern science. Just think of what you have witnessed in your life. I remember my father, who died in 1976, said he remembers when the first automobile drove into their valley in rural Arkansas, and he lived to walk to have people walk on the moon. That was in one lifetime, and he was just blown away that, you know, think of what you've seen in your lifetime and how much our understanding of the universe has changed and been enriched through the discoveries of science. Just going to take tonight one little example. That's the Hubble telescope. Can you ever look at the sky in the same way again? I remember when I was a kid, if you said the heavens, I thought, well, it's heaven, fluffy clouds, angels plucking harps, you know, and in my naive kind of view. Well, that's not what I think of when I look in the sky anymore. The heavens, when we think of that, you know, now brings to mind images that previous generations could not have imagined. You, for example, probably know that this photograph, very, very famous, is part of what are called the pillars of creation. Science has affected more than just the way we look at the heavens, although that's a big piece of it. Science has affected the way we look at every single aspect of the larger reality that we are part of. It seems like there's a science for every topic. For this reason, we're going to do what I just mentioned a few minutes ago. We're going to take a couple of weeks to look at simply two aspects of faith and see if, and there's an if here, so this is where you get your pencils out, if the way that we understand reality today in light of the science we have has anything to offer us as people of faith. The two topics I've chosen to take a whack at are belief in God, which is something I know Tom and Al have written a lot about, but also life after death. Tonight, all I want us to do is just take a look at this topic of belief in God and ask a relatively simple question that's not a simple question. Is it at least possible that science can give us new tools to articulate the way that we express our faith in God? That's sort of what's out there. And perhaps, and it's a perhaps, even to know that our faith in God is well grounded. Can anything in science help us in the grounding of the faith that we have? Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, admittedly, these 2 weeks are more speculative than the previous material. The more previous material is more descriptive of what, you know, again, so we're going to have a lot of opinions from a lot of people tonight. And this can be a strength as well as a weakness. That's why I'm saying have your pencil handy. There may be some things you want to critique or comment on or add to. And hopefully fodder for some good discussion tonight. Begin by something that we're probably all aware of. Much of the language and the images that we use for God predate even Newtonian science and go back thousands of years, even 3,000, to the ancient world and to a very different view of reality. The Bible being the chief example of that, but also Christian tradition and Christian theology. Aspects of ancient science and worldviews were incorporated into our scriptures, as well as how we understand and articulate the faith. For example, if you look at Genesis chapter 1, with the firmament above and the firmament below and the waters, this is, we know from the ancient literature of the ancient world, this is a Babylonian inverted bowl sort of worldview that is then taken in the Bible. Other things are incorporated too, even Greek metaphysics, things like God being immutable, God being infinite, and things like that. So a lot of ancient thought, very ancient thought, worldviews, even science, has become a part of our faith as it's been handed down to us. And yet these images have remained persistent across centuries. Many of the images that we use for God and to articulate our faith still speak to us in powerful ways. Some, I would argue, may be dated and maybe we would want to look at. There are issues related to this that we need to explore before we ask how science can be helpful in articulating faith. So our first few minutes, that's what we're going to explore. So let's just have some fun. Here is a picture that you probably know, although you're probably familiar with it, as this is just a small detail. If you ask where it's located, some of you know, most of you know, this is in the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican in Rome. It is, of course, by Michelangelo, and it depicts God. This is the Creation of Adam mural. And here's a question for us. What's wrong with this picture? Is anything wrong with it, theologically? I would argue there's plenty wrong with it. Now, it may seem like an odd question, but there are at least three things that are wrong with this picture, at least as an image for God. So just want to kick this around a bit. First of all, it is anthropomorphic, which is to say it pictures God as a human being. Michelangelo is not the only one to do that. Throughout history, you know, countless people have done that. We're going to depict God in a way we can relate to. We relate to God. So this is the classic, God is an old man with a flowing beard, you know, in heaven. Now, there are some clear advantages to this. For one thing, it's relatable. And we may remember that Jesus did address God as Father, and that may indeed be one of the driving factors behind this image. But just as clearly, there are limits to viewing God anthropomorphically. The power that lies behind the universe is far more than what we can picture as a human being. So this picture here, and a lot of art, might be helpful in communicating what is called God's immanence, that God is with us, God is present with us in a way that we can relate to. But it's probably not very helpful in communicating God's transcendence, that God is other, God is more than. It's the nature of any art. There are pluses and negatives. Now, at one level, you and I know that imaging God as a human is only metaphorical and analogical. But at another level, it's hard to give up too. The same thing was the two other aspects of this image that you probably have already figured out. God is male. Well, that raises some issues for people. God is white. That raises some issues for people. You probably know there's been a lot of pushback on both of those issues. We know that these characteristics, God is human, God is male, God is white, are not literally true, yet they're deeply rooted, and if you try to touch them, you can get a fight really quick. All of our images are culturally conditioned. We're from the European tradition, so we've inherited that tradition. Here's a case in point. Some of you have seen this before. How do you portray Jesus? Now, I grew up in a little Baptist church that basically said that we were against any images, so there was no cross on the church steeple. There was no cross on the altar. We didn't have any kind of images except this one image here was in the sanctuary and in every Sunday school class, which I thought was a little bit inconsistent, but we'll just go with that. So you may have seen this image or one like it. Well, how about this one? This is a more recent image that tries to more communicate what Jesus might look like, but again, pretty European. How about this one? If you've ever been to St. Luke Community Methodist Church or to an African American church, you may have seen Jesus portrayed as an African American. How about this? This comes from a church in China. We do the same thing with God. There's an old adage that says, you know, God created us in God's image, and we being gentle people return the compliment. We created God in our image. Here's a contemporary artist rendering of Michelangelo's creation of Adam. This is again from an African-American church. And if you ask people what's wrong, if you're from African-American tradition, you'd have probably no problems with this whatsoever. Some people from a European tradition might say, that's not the image I had in mind. Particularly when you compare it to Michelangelo's original in the Sistine Chapel, very European. Going back to the picture, here's a good question. Why even use anthropomorphic language and imagery at all? You know, what is it that we gain by doing that? Because obviously we do gain something. Why use male imagery? Or why do we use racial features? At this point, you might want to be reminded of the second commandment with a warning about the dangers of making images of God. Now, in our tradition as United Methodists, we don't take this literally. So we're comfortable using images and depicting God in art. And most of us probably enjoy, you know, looking at the great art across the centuries that does this. But it does serve as a reminder to take all images of God and all our language about God with a grain of salt. This is one of the reasons why the great thinkers of Christian tradition remind us again and again that any and all images and language of God, that includes all theological language, are never to be taken literally. They are analogies. They are representations. They're metaphors. Not literal, but it's a way of having something that you and I can relate to that serves in as a channel to help us maybe get an insight into God's nature. Many have argued, particularly among theologians, that the only way you can truly speak about God is by stating what God is not. There's a whole tradition here. It's called apophatic. The A means negative. The idea here is that if you want to know what God is, look at something in nature and say God's not that. So we often speak of God as being non-material, or probably the word you're familiar with is immaterial. But the idea is that God is not material. God is unchanging. God is ineffable. That's an interesting word. It literally means beyond the ability to describe. God is immortal. God is infinite, you know. And so there's a whole tradition here that says if you really want to get a handle on who God is, take something and simply negate it. And that's as close you're going to get to the nature of God. In the Eastern Orthodox Church, this thinking is particularly strong, the apophatic approach. When we talk about the reality of God, which is our topic tonight, we are not talking about this image. That's not what's up for discussion tonight, or any image. To talk about the reality of God, we're talking about the reality that lies behind the images and behind the language that we use. This is where science, I personally believe, can help us. Many other authors like John Polkinghorne would agree with this. It can give us a better understanding of what is out there, of what lies beyond all that we sense and experience. That's the nature of science. That's what science is good at. It can help us better understand what lies behind all the images and the metaphors and the language we use as we try, as best we can, to grasp or describe that reality that we refer to as God. It is important, or this is important, because many of the metaphors and much of the language we use, as I mentioned at the very beginning, come to us from earlier science, earlier worldviews. That is simply, we've inherited them. Science moved on, but some of our imagery did not. Now, I personally believe that science can help us in several areas. For one, it can help us to affirm the reality of God's existence. Sorry about that. That there is a greater reality in which, and as Paul in his speech to the Areopagus in the book of Acts says, the God in which we live and move and have our being. Paul is actually quoting a Greek philosopher at that point. But this is the idea that there is a larger reality that we participate in. And this is part of what we mean when we use the word God. It is a reality that transcends the natural order. This is why for Christians, traditionally, we do not simply equate God with the universe, pantheism, although you can, there are many permutations of that, but that God somehow or another transcends the natural order. In other words, the heavens can literally declare the glory of God in ways that we have previously, you know, found unimaginable. Now, if you're like me, you've had the typical experience that most of us have had, and maybe more when you were a kid, but you know, you remember what it was like to be out at night and simply gaze at the stars. Maybe it's a particularly dark, clear night, and maybe you can even see the Milky Way. And if your experience is like mine, in those moments, you can sense the vastness that lies beyond who we are. And also, if you're like me, get a sense of our own kind of insignificance. That can almost border on a mystical experience. This is likely what lies behind the opening verses of Psalm 119. We're not going to do a lot of scripture tonight, but here's one I thought, because I think this psalm is probably 3,000 years old, but I think it captures something that probably every one of us has experienced. This is what the psalmist says. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words, and no sound is heard from them. And yet, their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the earth. My experience in talking to people is that this is almost a universal experience of what looking at the sky at night and other things also can do. This affirmation that the heavens declare the glory of God, that we know God through God's creation, is a central part of our creation faith that we inherited from our Jewish tradition. That creation itself bears witness to the word of God. Now, I want to suggest to you that of all the signs tonight, this may be the key one. Let's do it again. A central part of our faith as Christians is the affirmation that creation itself bears witness to the God of creation. A lot that follows tonight is going to be predicated on this. The more science helps us to understand the wonders of the universe, and again, we live in that age, the more profound this part of our faith can become. Creation does indeed bear witness to the reality of God for people of faith. But the issue of proving God's existence and that language that you sometimes use is an entirely different matter. Historically, the Christian faith and the Jewish faith have affirmed God's existence, but have affirmed that it is not empirical, it is not factual, it is not physical. In other words, God's existence is viewed as spiritual, or sometimes the language we would use would be, in philosophy, would be metaphysical, or God is transcendent. Very familiar passage in John. God is spirit. Those who would worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Many scriptures make this basic affirmation. This means that the existence of God lies outside the limits of traditional empirical science and evidence and experiments, the forte of traditional science. And of course, if we know our philosophy science, we know that science by definition cannot prove anything. Proof is static and changing. Science is always open to new evidence, you know, much less anything that lies beyond the material world, like any spiritual reality. But let's be honest, this also creates a problem. How do you provide evidence or warrants for something, anything, that it exists, and do so non-empirically? When we've been kind of trained to think that the only way you can actually know something for sure is empirically. How do you demonstrate then the reality of God? When you cannot rely on traditional empirical evidence, when there is no where or place where you can go to find God. So let's have some fun. Some of us tonight are old enough to remember Yuri Gagarin and his story. He was the first Soviet in space, first human being in space. And he famously said, and by the way, there's a lot of debate about whether he actually said this. This became part of the Soviet propaganda, but Yuri Gagarin was actually a Christian. He was a member of the Russian Orthodox Church, and so there's a pretty good chance he never said this, but we'll just go with the story. I've supposedly the first man in space goes up and he says, "I've been to the heavens and God is not there. Therefore, there is no God." Of course, this assumed a pre-Newtonian view of God who was, quote, up there. You know, that was he 50 miles up, 100 miles up, you know, that kind of thing. And anything that Gagarin would have seen, of course, would not have been God, because we understand that God is not located in a particular thing at a particular point in time and space. His comments are based on out-of-date science and actually very bad theology. I tend to think probably he did not say that. That was probably the Soviet propaganda machine. Following the Enlightenment of the 1700s, and many of you know this story, philosophy and religion took what is called the inward turn. Essentially, what that means is that as we moved into the late 1700s and the 1800s and 1900s, increasingly, particularly at the intellectual level, the philosophical level, you see a grounding of our faith more in personal, internal experience than in things outside of ourselves. So that was a shift. It's called the inward turn. If you want to know the validity of faith, and by the way, one of those people would have been John Wesley. John Wesley wrote extensively on this. You know, he would argue that it is the testimony of the Holy Spirit in our hearts that is the valid testimony that we need to look. So you don't look for grounding of faith outside in the outer world. It's within your heart, within your soul, within your personal experience. But Wesley was just one example of a turning of that time. But that raises a question, and this is a fair question, of whether our faith is just purely subjective, in other words, it's just experience, or whether our faith is connected to the larger reality that lies outside of us, that there is an objective element to even subjective faith, that there is a God who is out there. So in the remainder of our time tonight, that's the issue I want us to kind of just explore a little bit. Of course, the idea that God is really out there has always been a central part of our faith. So I would think that any definition of the faith that turns itself 100% inward, that makes it purely subjective, purely experiential, would not be congruent with the faith that we have. Traditionally, our faith has embraced what is known as proofs for God's existence. Now, for a second, let's just take the word proof and play with it. We all know something. Proofs only tend to be accepted by people who already believe in God. So the word proof, let me say it this way, proofs don't prove. And that's just a why by the known fact. But proofs do play an interesting role. The traditional proofs are arguments. Some people say it's an argument for the existence rather than a proof. Are non-empirical. They tend to rely on logical arguments and, as we've already seen, on experience. Logical arguments, such as the ontological argument, which really has to do with the nature of the idea of God, is such that the argument says that God therefore necessarily must exist. Of course, people comment just because you can conceive of something doesn't make it necessarily so. And then some fairly bright people have said, well, that's true of everything except the one idea of God. There are also moral arguments. I know that Tom is versed in those. Where does our sense of morality come from? Our sense of right and wrong? That seems to be coming from somewhere. Now, many belittle arguments that are based on logic, but we need to remember just for a minute that mathematics is based on logic, and yet math has proven to have a direct relationship with reality. So there are some people who say there may be more to a logical argument than some people are willing to admit. You know, it's not just empirical evidence that matters in mathematics, it's the logic that matters. We'll talk about that more in a couple minutes. Other arguments are more directly from faith. Some would rely on miracles, although that can be a shaky ground because sometimes that's a God in the gaps, and if you can begin to explain miracles, then you may wind up with a more questioning of your faith. Again, religious experience. Maybe there. But here's where I want to go. And this is with the time we've got. The most common arguments for the existence of God, both within and outside the scientific communities, are the ones that are relevant for our series in science faith, are arguments that you might want to call cosmological. They involve what is known as a design, or as an argument from design, including things like the first cause, which goes back to the Greeks, the prime mover, which goes back to the Greeks, teleological arguments. Teleos has to do with the end of something, where it's headed. So these are arguments based on in the universe, we see purpose, we see direction, we see end. We've seen that the universe seems to be moving from point A to point B. It's got a direction, it's going somewhere. That would be a teleological argument, or simply the design argument itself, that there is order, there are structures, there are laws in the universe. You're going to hear a lot of scientists talk about that tonight. Here's the core argument: that we can infer there is a designer behind the design, that there is something or someone giving purpose or direction to the universe as it's being revealed to us today by science. There is nothing distinctly Christian about this approach. It predates Christianity. The design argument goes back to ancient times, at least as far back as the 4th century BCE. Plato and Aristotle both put forward this argument. But I thought one of the most eloquent ones from the ancient world is actually from Cicero, who is in the 1st century BCE. He has a treatise called On the Nature of the Gods, and in book 2, chapter 37, he has this little extended quote. When we see something moved by machinery like a clock, we do not doubt that these contrivances are the work of reason. When therefore we behold the whole compass of heaven moving with revolutions of marvelous velocity and executing with perfect regularity the annual changes of the seasons with absolute safety and security for all things, How can we doubt that all of this is evidenced not merely by reason, but by the reason that is transcendent and divine? Variations of that argument have been voiced ever since. Today in the area of science, there are several design arguments for the existence of God that are taken seriously, even by many within the scientific community. One of the most compelling, and the one that has most impressed physicists and mathematicians, like Einstein, is one we dealt with probably about 3 months ago. And it deals with what is called the meta question, the question that is above and beyond and behind all the other questions. Why is science even possible at all? Why are we able to understand the physical world at all? The answer lies, according to people who study this, in the rationality of the universe itself. Math and equations have the ability to explain the universe as well as the fundamental particles and forces. Remember that all of that theoretical physics and the things that have come out of that are all mathematically driven. There is a conformity between our capacity to reason with our minds and the reason built into the structure of the universe itself. All modern science is predicated on the belief that there is a pre-established harmony that does exist. It's there. It's a harmony between three things: the structure of reality itself, the universe, the nature of pure math and physics, and the ability of our individual minds to grasp that reality. It turns out that pure mathematics has proven to be key to unlocking the secrets of the universe. The deepest ideas of math invariably have consequences in physics and manifest themselves in matter. This is a statement you're going to see found in many, many places. It seems, to change metaphors, that the universe is knitted together by mathematics. One of the contemporary theoretical physicists out there says it this way: you could say that the universe speaks to us in numbers. Theologically, you could say that God speaks to us through mathematics. This is something even our greatest scientists have affirmed. 1936, Einstein wrote a book or paper called Physics and Reality, in which he said this: the eternal mystery of the world is its comprehensibility. The very fact that underneath the complexity and the diversity of the universe is a relatively simple order, E equals MC squared, things like that, is nothing short of a miracle or an eternal mystery. I hold it to be true that pure thought can grasp reality. That's through mathematics. There seems to be some deep connection between mathematics and physics. I would like to express this connection by saying that God is a mathematician. A mathematician who has constructed the physical world in such a way so as to bring out beautiful mathematical features. For Einstein, there was a clear connection between science and religion. 1930, he wrote a treatise on science and religion in which he said, science can only be created by those who are thoroughly imbued with the aspiration towards truth and understanding. This source of feeling, however, springs from the sphere of religion. To this, there also belongs the faith and the possibility that the regulations valid for the world of existence are rational. That is, comprehensible to reason. I cannot conceive a genuine man of science without that profound faith. The situation may be expressed by an image. Science without religion is lame, but religion without science is blind. Variations of this statement you've probably seen. For many, this argument, the mathematical argument, is compelling in and of itself. Sir John Polkinghorne, some of you may know, theoretical physicist, makes this comment. The remarkable insights that science affords us into the intelligible workings of the world cry out for an explanation more profound than that which science itself can provide. Scientists must be humble enough to learn from science. Let me write these two sides backwards. Let me just do this. Religion, if it is to be taken seriously, its claims that the world is the creation of God, must be humble enough to learn from science what that world is actually like. The dialogue between them, science and faith, can only be mutually enriching. This aspect of reality is reinforced by others that we've already looked at. So I'm just going to throw some things up against the wall that we've covered the last 5 months. From astronomy and astrophysics, we know that this has given us tools to talk about the origin of the universe, particularly the Big Bang, meaning that science no longer believes that the universe explains itself, but that the universe requires a transcendent cause, physicists using that language. Logically, if there's a beginning, a point where the universe came into existence, then the cause of the universe lies beyond the universe, beyond matter and energy, beyond time and space. Its origin, literally, the origin of the universe lies beyond the boundaries of the universe. It's one of the, in my thinking, that is one of the most profound thoughts that's out there. Science cannot say, of course, God exists. That's not a scientific statement. But it can say that the universe had a beginning, and that its cause lies beyond the universe itself. And its cause is literally metaphysical or supernatural or transcendent, whatever term you want to use. All of this is consistent, of course, with and reinforces belief in God, that there's something other. The other development coming to us out of astronomy and astrophysics, you may remember, is the anthropic principle, the fact that the universe is hospitable to life and to consciousness, when mathematically that is very improbable, that the universe seems to be fine-tuned to produce life, to produce us, consciousness, and that the chances of this being accidental and random are statistically zero. You may remember the Penrose number. The Big Bang and the anthropic principle reinforce the traditional design argument for the existence of God, grounded in mathematics. Other scientific breakthroughs have been helpful in articulating faith in God, and many people reference these. According to quantum physics, there's evidence from particular features of the laws of nature that the universe as a whole is not only hospitable to the growth of mind, but that the universe itself may, and let's put it this way, it bears many of the features of a mind, and it's have led some to think that it may be that the universe may in fact be a mind. That the existence of the universe implies or requires a consciousness behind all we see. This is the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics. Consciousness is required to collapse the probability into reality. Some of the scientific community use the language of God to refer to this consciousness. We saw quotes of that. Other principles in quantum physics have led some to see the very structure of the universe as analogous to the mind. Here are four. Non-locality, things can be many places at a time. Quantum entanglement, They stay connected even when separated. In determinism, things choose and decide. Consciousness lies behind all there is. By the way, all four of these characteristics are essentially characteristics of your brain. And yet quantum physics says they're also characteristics of the universe itself. At the boundaries of our science, with string theory and loop quantum gravity, the math says that matter, in the sense that we usually think of it, does not exist. But the universe is essentially made up of non-material strings of energy. Even matter is literally, and this is, and by the way, in recent literature, you begin to get this language, you'll find statements not about matter, but energy in the form of matter. Remember, E equals MC squared equals matter is energy in the form of matter. Throughout most of history, the term for the non-material reality was spirit. Recently, this is a book I just actually finished last week, those working on the nature of dark energy and dark matter, and the first moments of time, first seconds of time, first fractions of a second of time, that using both mathematics and empirical data from the Fermi Gamma Ray Telescope have used the language of the anthropic principle to explain the existence of our universe with the amount of dark energy it has. Turns out that the amount of dark energy is not just a statement of there's just X amount there, but if the amount of dark energy were less or more than it is, we would not be here. It's just one more example of the anthropic principle. Science has even made contributions in our understanding of religious experience, helping us to understand that there is something within us, within our human nature, that resonates or correlates with the spiritual and the reality of God. We do not know of a single society anywhere in the world at any point in history that did not believe in the spiritual and believe in God. Even Neanderthals seem to have had religious rituals around death from their graves. It seems to be ubiquitous for human nature. Some scientists believe they have found the quote God spot, this is several years old, in the frontal lobes of the cerebral cortex. If this spot is stimulated with electricity, people report having a religious experience. And so some have used that to say, well, this is just, you know, there's nothing out there. It's just simply, you know, that something triggers that. Others believe that the God spot is not just one spot. It, in fact, is the brain as a whole. In other words, just as the universe itself is hardwired to be rationally understood by mathematics and the human mind, we are hardwired biologically to experience God. That's an interesting thought. That our brains are hardwired to be in tune with God, and that we are fine-tuned to have religious experiences. Of course, once again, none of this proves the existence of God. And just remind ourselves, proof is never on the table. Even when you're talking about proofs for the existence of God, it's not really proofs, it's more arguments. The point is whether or not it's reasonable to be a person of faith and to believe in God. Whether it's plausible, so it's not proof, it's the reasonableness, the plausibility, whether we have grounds to believe, warrants reasons. And that's the language you're going to see used in this literature. More to the point of this series, whether modern science provides us with any of these warrants. Any way you look at it, and by the way, let me back up. I would argue that in the material that we've covered in this course and the material I've sort of highlighted tonight, there are significant warrants and reasons there. But any way you look at it, we have come light years from a science and a worldview that eliminated even the possibility of God existing and just kind of poo-pooed the spiritual, to a scientific worldview today that seems to be substantially out there, in which the existence of God is taken seriously, not by everyone, but even by people within the scientific community itself. A world in which it's science itself that has compelled many to believe, and in which many of the most vocal and articulate proponents for belief in God actually have come from within the scientific community itself. So for that, we end, and then next week we'll try to do a similar kind of run through with the topic of life after death.